It contains violence, adult language, nudity, and adult content.
Good evening, everybody, and sorry for the weird pause at the beginning of the show, having a headset issue that I think is now resolved. I'm going to double-check that real quick. I have somebody checking to see if I can be heard. At any rate, let's go ahead and start this over, and I'll tell you the parts that you missed. So thank you for joining us. It's part two of the 51st episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is the ever-patient Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We'll be taking calls from our listeners all evening during this show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on Blog Talk Radio as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro, and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. Alrighty. Apologies, we're having an issue again, technical difficulties, but the music was lovely. So please let us know the name of the song and the artist and relevance to tonight's topic.
Well, that actually was written by one of my favorite old-timey blues guys, Willie Dixon, who was also the guy that wrote Spoonful and a Hoochie Coochie Man, and just a shoot ton of amazingly great records that just any number of people have reproduced. It was originally recorded by Howlin' Wolf, who's also one of my favorite blues guys, old school blues guys, for Chess Records, I think in 54. And then he re-recorded it, in 69, and it was like a huge hit. The name of the song, by the way, is called Evil. Yeah. And I thought, given tonight's topic, that would kind of be kind of cool. And the song has been reproduced since that time just by a shoot ton of people, you know, including Cactus and Dee Snider with Widowmaker, The Dead Daisies, Steve Miller, for God's sake, Derek and Dominoes, Canned Heat, Gary Moore. I mean, it's been definitely made the rounds, and that's just a really, really cool song. I was doing it more in the up-tempo Gary Moore, Dead Daisies, Widowmaker style, as opposed to the original, which is a lot tamer. However, I just thought it'd be a great piece for tonight's show, given the fact that we're going to be talking about things that, in some cases, I think people would consider not kosher. So there you go.
Understatement of the day. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, well, yeah, I'm good for that.
Mathis, as Dr. Mathis mentioned, tonight's episode is entitled The Me Too Movement and Sexual Abuse, and this is part two. Our last episode 2 weeks ago was part one, and we'll discuss that in a moment. Before we begin tonight's topic discussion, let's go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Okay, so I thought I would talk about, since I've been, on a gear mode, I thought I would talk about an oft maligned and sometimes praised, depending on who you talk to, guitar called the Gibson Explorer, which debuted in way back in 57, I think. The patent originally was obtained in 58, but it didn't go on production until 57, I think, mid-57, maybe June. And it was a highly unpopular guitar when it got released. It was just too, like, radical and weird, and what the hell is this crap? So, it also morphed into another guitar that Gibson put out called the Futura, which was equally as maligned. I call it the kind of weird three or the weird four, which was the Futura, the Explorer, the Moderne, and the Flying V, all of which came out in the 50s and all of which were huge flops when they came out, but have since become like, you know, woohoo and everybody loves them kind of thing. And so when they debuted it at a Chicago music store and during, I think, a NAMM, 57 NAMM show, that's the annual show for music people. They had a booth for folks to come in and look at it, and, you know, it was considered to be the most modernistic guitar of the day, and, you know, people were like, what the hell is that? people were like freaking. And the only other one that came out around that time, other than those, besides the Flying V and the Futura and the Moderne, which were all listed as modernistic guitars at the time, they all came out, and it was like this ridiculously cheap. Well, I mean, not cheap for the time, I guess. I think we went on for around $250, which is like, whoa. You know, in today's market, that would be like ridiculous. People would be scarfing those things like a son of a bitch. So it was really, you know, people didn't know what to do with it because, you know, they were used to the, you know, more traditional style guitars, and people just went, what the hell? Like the Flying V, it's kind of brother guitar. It was made of Carina wood, and a lot of those Pauls are made of Carina too, which is a really cool, dense, piece of wood that transmits sound incredibly well, and but it's really, really hard to work with. It's very dense and very, you know, it's a hard wood. And so it's really kind of a pain in the butt to work with, but it just sounds really wonderful. And that's why you don't see too many people doing Carina woods anymore unless they're masochists or doing special editions. Or in some cases, so a lot of your boutique dealers will do them, like a Taya. Does a lot of his upper-end guitars out of Carina wood, and they're really stunning, but I don't want to digress here too much. So anyway, the original Explorer and the V had the split V headstock. So people kind of went, okay, the Gibson guys kind of went, you know, maybe we need to do something else. So it eventually ended up having like this golf flag headstock like the Charvels do. And so they ended up doing that. It was a little, it's a more rounded headstock than the Charvels, which are very pointy, or the Jacksons, which are very pointy. But this one had sort of a round golf tee flag kind of thing. But it started out with a split V headstock. And sometimes when Gibson does the reissues, they'll do the split V stock. So it ended up being like one of the lowest produced guitars ever. You know, I think they made something like 20 of them. I mean, they just didn't sell worth a damn, and they made like 20 of them. Yeah, compared, for example, and this is really kind of, and I mean, that was even lower than the Flying V's. They made about 80 Flying V's, which was considered kind of low, and maybe 30 double necks at the time. You know, and most of the ES guitars, the Electro Spanish guitars, they were making, you know, anywhere from, you know, 40 to, you know, 200, depending on how many there were. The top of the food chain for Gibson, for the hollows of the semi-hollows of the Birdlands, and I think they made like 60 or 70 of those back in the day. It was considered to be a mid-price Gibson. It was the same price as a Les Paul Goldtop, which everybody just loved, and people were like, oh my God, and they made like 440 of those. So just to kind of give you a sense of the disparity between their uber popular model and people and the models, people going, what the hell is that? Right. So there's only about 22 of those that are left today out of all the ones they produced, because they produced them for a while, excuse me, and they basically dropped them because they weren't selling. And then In the 60s and 70s, when some of the guitar players, including Eric Clapton and, you know, a variety of folks who went, well, this is kind of an unusual, kind of rare guitar, started playing them, people kind of got an interest in them again. So, you know, you see the guy for Jeff Carlisi, the guitar player, used to be a 38 Special, plays one. You know, and I've seen people like Rick Derringer with them, and I mean, you see them popping up. Matthias Jobs, the lead guitar player that permanently replaced Uli Roth in Scorpions, has played an Explorer since day one, just about, and that's been his go-to guitar. Yeah. Who's the skinny guy that got injured in a plane crash? Alan Collins. The guitar player, one of the three guitar players for Lynyrd Skynyrd, he typically played very weird Gibsons, and he played Firebirds and Explorers. So, you know, you see these things popping up. So if you can get one of the original ones, and there's I think the 3 or 4 years they were originally made, they only have 22 of them left. And just to kind of give you an idea, Clapton sold his at one of his Crossroad auctions to raise money for his drug treatment center. And I think it was in 1999, he sold this 58 Explorer that went for roughly $130,000.
Wow.
So, yeah. So, FYI. Right. And when you talk to some of the guys, there's a couple of guys who still who have worked for Gibson and were there during that period, or came in right after that period. And one of their guys, Marvin Lamb, said that they were giving those things away. They had a bunch left over, and they would just had them sitting on the wall. And they basically said, hey, if any of you guys want to take these home, be my guest. And most of them, of course, went, the hell with that. That's the ugliest thing I've ever seen, right? And they were interviewing Marv Lamb about it not too long ago, and he said, yeah. He goes, you know, I could have just taken one of these homes, and, you know, at the time I thought, oh, my God, this is the ugliest things I've ever seen. They're way ahead of their time, but they're ugly as hell, right? And he goes, you know, now I wish to heck I'd have taken a few of them for myself and sold them. Because they're going for, like, if you get one of the originals, they're going for crazy money. Now, of course, Gibson has reissued them and continues to reissue them, and then they are really popular. But, you know, so are the V's. And the V's were the same way. The V's and the Moderns and all those guitars, you know, people were looking at them going, oh, my God, those things are ugly as hell. But they have, you know, had a new – they've come back to life. So it's been kind of a good thing. I actually have a couple of Explorers. I like them. But a lot of people think they're too top-heavy. And honestly, the ones that I have are not top-heavy. They're very, very well-balanced. I have heard people say that some of them are not balanced and top-heavy, but that has not been my experience. And people say that sometimes about the reverse Firebirds also, and I just – that has not been my experience. And I have six or seven Firebirds. I love them. So, you know, if everybody thinks they're weird and ugly and whatever, more power to you, but I love them. I love the tone of them. They've got humbuckers like most Les Pauls, and they're definitely a raunchy guitar. They're not for the you're not going to play Fly Robin Fly on them, let me put it that way. You know, so there you go. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
All right. Thank you for that.
Sure.
Again, we will be taking calls from listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight. Please feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. So tonight's show is called The Me Too Movement and Sexual Abuse, and it's part two. As with many of our chosen topics on this show, this topic is both emotionally volatile for many people, and it has some deeply political overtones. But just to be clear to our listeners, the purpose of our show is always to bring empirical, psychological understanding to our layperson listeners. So it's imperative to remember that we are addressing this strictly from a mental health and psychological perspective. If it may seem that we are taking a side, that reaction too is about psychology, but it does not mean we are doing so. We simply feel that improved mental health and coping require us all to have to be collectively resilient and self-aware enough to look at the difficult and painful aspects of our behaviors, to process them accurately and in a healthy manner. The Me Too movement actually began back in 2007, but 10 years later exploded just last year on social media due to some heavily public celebrity attention to the topic. This has been a heretofore largely ignored and covered up phenomenon, which through the serendipity of perfect timing finally is getting the attention and scrutiny that it deserves. Many people who have had no validation finally have it. Yet, as always seems to happen, there is a point at which this metaphorical pendulum swings too far the other way, doing damage to people who may not have earned it, as well as eroding the credibility of the movement and alarming people to go back to silence once again. This movement and the fallout from it have suffered from overzealousness, abuses of reporting, fabrications, overreactions, revenge, and other toxic uses of its key tenets. Tonight, we're focusing on exactly this aspect of the Me Too and Time's Up movements and similar sentiments and how they can be misused by riding the exuberance of their success such that accusations are automatically not just believed but acted on without full verification. So tonight, we will discuss two main sections. First, the darker side of victim response, misuse of reporting as revenge or power, overexuberance, witch hunt mentality, pitchforks and torches culture, kind of the same thing, and lack of balance. And then the next part is resources and advice for improving both victim support and accuracy of accusations. Please be clear that we are not here to gaslight stories or take away the hard-earned gravitas of legitimate stories. We are only asserting that we cannot ignore the ways in which such movements can go wrong and do harm to those who did not earn it, as well as that we cannot ignore those who Arcot that seem to never have a consequence. There's a third category in between where someone may have been tasteless or inappropriate, but it did not fall under the magnitude of actual assault or molestation. We will try to cover all these variant aspects of the problem. Please also note that a few times tonight I will be sharing articles that I do not necessarily feel exemplify the points we want to make very well, or that are even controversial or contentious. But I'm doing this to raise important talking points, and I feel that they will serve that purpose. And I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, before we get started on the meat and potatoes here.
Nope, I'm good. Serve the main course.
All righty, let's get down to business. So, technically part three, because this is a two-part episode. The darker side of victim response. Misuse of reporting as revenge or power, overexuberance, pitchforks and tortures, lack of balance, and so on. Okay, introduction to this section. In order to understand about some of the fringes and problems of this topic, it's important to understand psychologically the unique place that rape and sexual abuses hold in our society, culture, and personal notions. So when we bring up a movement this large, we have to have a conversation about its ultimate goals and our boundaries and expectations of people. We expect victims to come forward and jump on this social bandwagon. We expect those who may have done rude and stupid things to do some nebulous acts of contrition and fixing, yet we cannot well articulate what that even looks like and often won't accept it even if they do bother. Our relationship with contrition and amends is fractured and vague, and the same with self-improvement and growth. We do not leave people any room to stop an old bad behavior or to apologize and make up for it. The means and path to do better has to be present, or why would anybody bother trying to address things? Even if it is the moral thing to do, our deliberate failure to accept sincere contrition damages our ability to receive any. Let's look at the psychology of self-improvement and bullying as motivation. What is one expected to do if there's some past sin that previously never got caught? Are moral people obligated to preemptively out and punish themselves, or what? Why would they if we never allow them to pay for their wrongs and to move along from having that wrong define them for the rest of their lives? And parenthetically, here we are speaking of those lesser wrongs. The crude joke, the young drunk, stupid comment, or other acts further back on the spectrum from actual abuse or assault. None of this applies to someone who flat out commits clear acts of abuse. And at this point, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, especially about the aspect of the psychology of contrition and how much is enough to move on.
You know, that really depends on the person or group of folks you talk to about this. I mean, I think that's a hard thing to define, and I think what our culture likes to do is dichotomize folks. And so if you do one good act, you know, you have what I call the halo effect, you know, which is, I think, also a term folks use. And, you know, it's like, okay, so you did the one good thing, so that means you're smart and cute and handsome and beautiful and competent and, you know, ad infinitum, and you can't do anything bad. And that's sort of the opposite of what I jokingly call the pitchfork effect, which is, you know, you do one stupid thing and now you're evil, wicked, mean, and nasty. So I think what we need to do is understand that people are complicated animals, and that sometimes people make mistakes out of ignorance or youth or whatever. You know, and I think there's a difference in somebody who does something once or twice as a stupid error and then apologize. And, you know, and again, I'm not talking about rape or murder or, you know, abduction of little children and, you know, locking them in a torture chamber and all that kind of crap. Mm-hmm. But I think there's at some point, you know, all of us have made errors. I mean, I certainly have done my share of dumbass things, and I would be a liar if I said I hadn't. But it's kind of like I say to people when, you know, patients come in, and I had this happen this week. I had someone call in and say, hey, you know, I screwed up. I've been clean and sober for a year or two, and I had a relapse, and I didn't tell you about it, and I'm really sorry because I'm all ashamed and yada, yada, yada. And I said to this person, you know, thank you for calling and telling me that, but you have nothing to apologize for. You didn't lie to me. I didn't ask you, so that, you know, hello. It's not like I asked you, hey, how you doing? And you went, oh, great, I'm still doing my thing, right? So, you know, I think we have a habit as people to want to, you know, all or none ourselves as well, and do this thing that, you know, cluster B's do, all splitting, all good, all bad, no shades of gray, you know? And I said to this person, you know, you show me a person who hasn't made an error, and I'll show you God. And that isn't you or me, right? And I've done stupid shit in my past, too. And some of the things I've done are not real proud of, you know, things I did in my youth before I, you know, had a clue and a brain. And, you know, I'm not happy about it, and I'm not proud about it, but I can't go back and change it. All I can do is learn from them and go, okay, makes note. Don't do these kind of jokes again. I know they're kind of cute and funny in some kind of way, but they're kind of, you know, some folks are going to find that really hurtful, and maybe you want to shut your mouth. You know, so you just have to learn and look at your stuff. And I think that some point, if somebody comes in, like this person that calls me and says, hey, you know, I know I'm coming in for a session on Thursday, but this is, you know, Friday, whenever this person's session is, Friday, Saturday, I forget when it is this week. You know, I wanted to call and apologize up front because I feel bad about it. Well, that already tells me the person's sorry for what that person did, and that person's regretful and beating the crap out of themselves. And I'm like, hello, chill. You know, you made a slip up.
Yeah.
Okay, got it. Thank you for admitting it. Thank you for being concerned about it. That's great. Don't sit there and pull a baseball bat and beat the shit out of yourself. That's not going to help you. All that's going to do is increase your anger at yourself, your frustration, diminish your self-esteem, and make you feel, you know, and all those kind of emotions and things that'll cause people, you know, if they're going to relapse, that's the kind of things that lead them to relapse. I'm like, bad idea. you know? And you don't owe me an apology, but thank you, you know. And, hey, let's learn from it, and let's analyze what you were saying to yourself, the little slips you made in your brain before you actually went, dude, I think I'll go buy a pound of Coke. That person didn't do that, but I'm just saying.
No good.
Right. And so, yeah, it was half a pound. So, yeah. You know, it's the same kind of thing with this. And, again, I'm not talking about somebody, you know, who does grossly inappropriate things and then tries to hide them. You know, I think if somebody does grossly inappropriate things and then comes forth and says, look, I screwed up, or gets caught and says, yep, you know what, I screwed up, I'm guilty, I shouldn't have done that, or whatever. Okay, then let's figure out what we can do to protect the victim, and let's figure out what we can do to protect future victims from this person. And does that mean this person needs to spend time apart from society, or does this person need to pay the damaged party a fee, some kind of monetary recompense, or pay for that person's therapy or whatever? But you know, once that's over, you need to let that shit go. And that's the same, struggle that a lot of persons who are incarcerated, you know, face. They come out, and they've done something real dumb. They've made a really bad mistake in their youth, and they've paid for it by spending several years in prison. And they come out, and they've got a record, and then people don't want to hire them. And I'm like, hello? It's over. Get over it. This person's paid their dues to society. This person's not reoffending. What the hell's your problem? And I think that's where, you know, that's where some of this stuff is heading. You know, what do you do from somebody who, now, you know, you have a repeat offender, somebody who's been caught two or three or four times doing this shit. That's a whole different story.
Yeah.
And I'm not suggesting we need to stand them, right, and I'm not suggesting we need to stand them up at a firing squad or whatever, but we certainly need to go to much more lengths to protect future victims and to help rehab the current victims of this person, and to make sure this person is going to have a smaller window of opportunity to do this kind of stuff. Again, we do this with sex offenders. You know, we register certain sex offenders, and they can't. And if it's a child sex offender that, you know, who repeatedly offends a certain age group, they can't go around that age group. So, you know, I think there's certain things we can do to do that. But I think if somebody does something, even, I mean, it's like, you know, you break somebody's, you know, guitar, I'm just going to say, since I'm a guitar nut, you know, you accidentally fracture somebody's guitar, you break somebody's guitar string, where do you go buy another one? You go fix it. You know, you make up for it, you say you're sorry, you own it, and you move on. That's all any of us can do, right? you just don't go back and do the same stupid shit that got you to break the string or the guitar in the first place. You don't go do it again. You have to go back and look at your stuff and go, okay, what did I say to myself? What was I doing? What was I feeling? What was I thinking that led me to do this stupid stuff? And, you know, we just need to move on. And I think that we have a tendency to hold on to this kind of stuff when you see repeated similar events happen, like you know, you have 4 or 5 rape cases come up, you know, in a 2 or 3 month period, and you're like, what the hell? You know, and so people, the next one that comes along, that somebody makes a stupid joke by the water cooler, you know, in the office that's, you know, sexist or racist or whatever, or somehow inappropriate, and people go nuts and want to have this person fired. Come on, really? Okay, what you want to do is educate the person and say, okay, this is why this kind of behavior is inappropriate. You know, you got a red mark on your, you know, on your report card, or a black mark on your report card, or whatever. But, you know, don't be doing this shit again. Here's your warning. You know, but we want to go crazy with this kind of stuff because we're so sensitized when you see 2 or 3 or 4 of these things. You know, it's like the shootings in the schools. And granted, that's something people ought to get crazy about. But, you know, somebody does something stupid or makes an inappropriate joke about, you know, guns or shooting, and now that you think this guy's or gal's going to, you know, bring an Uzi to school, you know, we have to look at our own stuff and how we overreact to the stuff. But it's kind of like having an open wound. You know, you do anything to the open wound and it hurts a lot more than before you first injured it to begin with. And I think we're seeing a lot of this coming up with folks who are so traumatized, if you will, from all the crazy shit that people are doing, that when another thing comes up, people are going again, and they want to overreact, and then they want to punish the most recent offense, you know, like the backlog of stuff they've got. And it's like, okay, well, this person did it. Now we need to, you know, hit this person out and draw them, quarter them, and, you know, take their names off monuments and, you know, do all kinds of crazy shit, even when they haven't even done that much that's bad. That's all that bad, and we want to go crazy with it because we're so daggum sensitized. And it's understandable because it's a form of trauma. Even those of us who haven't been directly impacted by these kind of things, you know, you read about it, you see it on TV, you hear about it, and it shakes you. You know, we like to think of ourselves as civilized animals, and we're really not that civilized. I mean, I hate to tell people, we're really not that civilized. So I think that's the problem.
Fair enough. Okay. And I'm going to get into another sub-aspect of that just now.
Sure.
So last time we talked about rape culture. So I'm curious about what the psychological aspect is that we have rape culture, but we don't have, like, theft culture, murder culture, assault culture, and so on. And understanding what this is for us is kind of a core of this whole entire topic. You know, our relationship with this particular question is unique. So I'm curious if you have any thoughts on what are we doing with this? Why do we do this?
Well, I can only give you my own thoughts about that. I mean, certainly theft, mm-hmm. murder, assault, rape, those are all boundary transgressions. You know, mm-hmm. and as far as I'm concerned, you know, and this is going to be a gross overgeneralization, so I don't want anybody to freak out when I say this. Excuse me. But a boundary transgression is a boundary transgression. You know, so, you know, they're all equally culpable. Now, certainly, I'd rather have somebody steal something from me than murder me. Okay, so on a scale of 1 to 10, right, or rape me, okay, or beat the shit out of me, okay. But I think the reason that rape is kind of a special section of what I'm going to call the boundary transgressional acts is because I think that goes back to us thinking of ourselves as civilized, and civilized people don't do that kind of stuff. You know, people can think, okay, people lose their temper, they put their host to the wall, they beat their friend up, they slap their lover, whatever. You know, or they get very frustrated because they haven't, you know, had enough nutrition during the day, and they're in a car and they get pissed off, and they, you know, somebody cuts in front of them and they stop at a stop sign and they go in and, you know, smack them through the window, or beat the shit out of the car with a baseball bat or whatever. It's like, oh, you know, you have an explanation for that. Okay, it was too hot, you didn't eat, you know, well, yada, yada. Murder, that's a little harder, but it's like, you know, we can't have that because we're going to deplete the population here. You know, so, but, you know, you've seen these kind of things throughout history. Rape, and while you've seen rape throughout history too, I'm not trying to say it hasn't been, I think rape is something, you know, it has to do with the sex stuff, and particularly in America, because I hate to say it, but Americans are very repressed in general. I mean, if you go over to Europe or Asia or, you know, Scandinavian countries, I mean, they have a very different view about sex and age of consent and all this stuff than we do. And I think part of that's because, you know, this country was settled back in the day by people who are puritanical and, you know, who are much more religious. And this whole country is founded, I think, certainly founded on religious freedom. And part of that goes with religious, you know, edicts against premarital sex and certain kinds of sexual positions, which are still illegal in many states in this country. FYI, for those listeners who don't know that. And, you know, it's the same thing with, you know, the accepting homosexual folks and, you know, legalizing gay marriage and all this. You know, this is a big deal over here. And I'm not suggesting the marriage thing isn't a big deal in some other countries, too. But there's a lot of countries who are a lot more liberal and understanding and recognize that we're humans and we have sexual drives. And those aren't relegated to traditional male-female gender typing and sexual stuff. I mean, there's some Asian cultures have four different kinds of genders. Yeah, you know, they don't just have male and female. Right. Native Americans have another gender type that we don't have, that, you know, us white bred Americans don't have. And so
the two-spirit thing.
Yeah. Yes. And I think what's happened is that we have forgotten that we're basically white, you know, white bred, if you will. And I mean that not as a slam against Caucasians, but, you know, this country was founded by Eastern, you know, white, Eastern Northern Europeans and UKans, if you will. You know, and we're basically, you know, white European culture started this country. And so it's very repressed sexually in many ways. And I think that's tied to the rape thing. And it's like, oh my God, good, you know, good Christian, Jewish, whatever. We can't be raping people. Oh no, my God. Oh no, we're beyond that. And I think that strikes to not only our vulnerability as people when we think that we're in charge of our own bodies, but how quickly we can revert to basic animalistic tendencies, if you will. And we're not that sophisticated as we think we are. And I think that shakes our core belief system about ourselves and our self-view. And I think that's one reason that's so, you know, shocking for folks and so difficult for folks.
Got it. Okay, good. Thank you for that.
Sure.
The next part that I want to bring up is a sidebar about the relevance of the age of the victim or the target. When the sexual abuse happens at younger ages with persons we expect to have our best interests at heart, probably, you know, like parents, teachers, you know, that sort of thing, clergy, with persons in positions of power and trust, and happens repeatedly, the more psychological damage that occurs and the more difficult it is for the brain to recover, particularly when it's with children or teens during key developmental periods. So I wanted to check in with you here if you could kind of expound on the difference between children and teens versus adults being abused in this way.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, I mean, if you think developmentally, right, our brains are developing a lot between 0 and 6 or so, and then slows down a little bit, but they're still going. And our key development periods are roughly between birth and 18. I mean, if you look at the studies, for example, with pot users, regular and heavy pot smokers, there was a study came out a couple of years ago where folks were interviewing regular pot users in their 30s, and they had talked about, I think they were in the 30s, talked about when they started using and how frequently, and what they, and I'll save you the gory details. So the bottom line of the gory details is that those people who started using marijuana after age 20 or 21 only lost, and who were regular and heavy users, only lost about 5 IQ points. Those who started prior to that lost like 15 IQ points. And that's because it interfered with the brain's developing, because you're putting a chemical in the brain that's impairing its ability to differentiate appropriately. So you shock the craziness out of somebody. You have war trauma. You have repeated assaults. You live in a dangerous neighborhood where you could be beaten up, killed, murdered, tortured, abused, whatever. You're in constant fight or flight mode. That does different things to your brain. That secretes a set of chemicals that your brain is not prepared to deal with. And the same, you know, applies to rape, you know, or repeated abuse. That kind of stuff happens. It begins to change the structure, the morphology of your brain, because it causes the brain to secrete different neurochemicals and be in constant fight or flight, DEFCON 4 mode. And that really does a number on your brain's ability to differentiate appropriately and has usual devastating effects on your ability to socialize later in adulthood, your ability to trust folks, your dating expectations, your relationships of all kinds. You know, it's pretty impactful. And it's particularly impactful if it happens, as you mentioned earlier, with folks in positions of power, whether they're clergy, teachers, therapists, parents, siblings, whatever, brothers, cousins, you know, anybody, uncles, babysitters, you know, and if that happens repeatedly of people who are supposed to protect you, then you start to think, well, wait a minute, if these people have my best interest at heart and they're not protecting me, what chance do I have that a stranger is, you know, or supposedly a friend or supposedly a, you know, a lover, girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever, how the hell, what assurance do I have that they're not going to do this shit? So it's really, really does a number on the development of your brain and your ability to trust and bond with people, hugely, if it happens, you know, prior to, you know, adulthood. And then rule of thumb is the earlier it happens, the more often it happens, the more aggressively it happens, and the more it happens with people who are in trusted positions or positions of power that you look up to and expect to protect you and have your best interests at heart, the more damage is done.
Got it. Fair enough. Okay. So the next part that we want to talk about is, I have an article to go along with this point and a couple of points here. So why is it that suddenly accusations that had gone on for decades were finally taken seriously? And this is actually an episode of NPR. It's a podcast, so there's not a lot of notes, but it does raise some good questions. So it's called The Psychological Forces Behind a Cultural Reckoning, Understanding #MeToo. And this is the Hidden Brain podcast, which is hosted by Shankar Vedantam and produced by Maggie Penman, Jennifer Schmidt, Rihanna Cohen, Parth Shah, and Renee Klar. And this was from February 5th of this year. And they mention, nearly a quarter century ago, a group of women accused a prominent playwright of sexual misconduct. A Boston newspaper published allegations of sexual harassment, unwanted touching, and forced kissing. For the most part, the complaints went nowhere. Why now? In 2017, more women came forward with accusations. This time, everybody listened. On this episode of Hidden Brain, we explore the story through the lens of social science and ask, why now? What has changed in our minds and in our culture so that allegations of sexual harassment and assault are being taken so much more seriously than they were in prior decades? I'll check in and see if you have anything to add to that before I go to the next part.
Yeah, I think part of that is that we're seeing it happen more often, and we're becoming more aware of it. And you know, we're just a little more in touch with this kind of stuff. And you know, when you start to have a bunch of people going and reporting the same stuff, it's like, okay, maybe this shit's really happening. So I think now we're listening because we're seeing it come up so much, and then it's, you know, caused other folks to go, hey, wait a minute, that happened to me too. No pun intended.
Well, maybe it is intended in this case. That's how it got to be a hashtag. So, you know, related to that, the next article snip that I have is about the realization about how prolific these stories were and why people are so private about this in a way that they are not about other crimes. And also I want to talk about some consequences of this movement having happened. So the article is called Psychologists' Reactions to the Me Too Movement. Dr. Kristen Daly and Dr. Rachel Kitson discussed the viral activism of the Me Too movement. And this was by a website called shrinktank.com and was posted October 25th of 2017. And they say, given the magnitude of the movement, two of our clinicians, Drs. Kristen Daly and Rachel Kitson, who have experience working with victims of sexual trauma, were interviewed regarding their reactions and thoughts on the Me Too outbreak. First question, what was your initial reaction to seeing the increase in popularity in the Me Too movement? Dr. Rachel Kitson, I think I was slow to pick up on it as a movement. I'm not very prolific on or attached to my social media accounts, and my husband, who I thought was even less social media oriented than me, was actually the first person to draw my attention to it. He noticed his mother had posted Me Too and filled me in on how the phrase was being used / co-opted. I encouraged him to ask his mother about it as he had been unaware of her experience. I figured that was maybe what part of the movement was about, starting a dialogue. But I guess my first reaction was actually a little negative. I wondered, what woman can't share a Me Too? Which I know is part of the problem. Dr. Kristen Daly says, I happened to check Facebook and saw that a dear friend had posted the statement, hashtag me too, and the description as to why she was posting. As the status updates appeared more and more frequently, I found myself feeling that it was overwhelming to realize how many of my friends and family had not only been through sexual abuse, but were also brave enough to share it openly. After a couple of days, I realized that I pretty much felt that every woman had been through some kind of experience and the cumulative impact those experiences have on our sexual identity. Next question. Did you have something to share, and if so, did you? KD, my first impulse when I saw the posts were that I wanted to create a post of my own. Yes, I have been through these experiences, but the challenge is that it is not something I would ever want to discuss in a public forum. Because I'm impulsive, I found myself composing the post before I thought through what it would be like to be so open about something that is so private. RK, I definitely also thought about how my audience might respond to me sharing. So I stewed on it for a day or two, reflecting on the fact that I, too, had been a, quote, victim in at least one blatant assault and many, many other questionably insidious forms of harassment. And I started to get pissed off. Most of my social media contacts are white and privileged people, and there were very few active contributors who weren't also acknowledging their, quote, Me Too status, which just reaffirms the sickening pervasiveness of the problem. But I toiled with how to share my status. Next question. What do you see as some of the ramifications of this movement? RK. For some, it provided an empowering forum to put in black and white that this had happened. There are a few forums in life to share such information, and I think that helps strip the power of the trauma and provides community support, awareness, and ultimately, hopefully, change. I think for some people it was maybe a little traumatic to bear witness to. For those who have been a victim and have not felt empowered and have not spoken out, I think watching this unfold could be very difficult. Many victims feel guilt, shame, and like they are somewhat at fault or let whatever happened happen. They don't feel emboldened, and this could have been hard to process. I think some people who became aware through this movement that people they loved and knew had been victims could potentially feel blindsided and struggle to know what to do with the information, to bring it up or not. Katie's answer. For individuals, the effect can be the disclosure of very personal information, which can stimulate some important yet painful conversations. In thinking about the disclosures, I'm very hopeful that people can be open and accepting, but there are likely going to be some people who try to minimize or discredit their experiences. Discrediting the victim has been a pretty effective legal strategy in courts, and I have been an unfortunate witness to the way that people's trauma gets devolved into a he said, she said legal dead end. There can be a tendency to perceive a person sharing as being part of the bandwagon, which can be used to invalidate their story. However, the challenge with the popularity of the movement can be that the overall message gets lost. Next question. When we assume that every woman has been through sexual harassment or assault, we actually reinforce rape culture. This happens in two harmful mindsets, and these are not from the doctors. This is just from the article itself. First, the assumption that being harassed or assaulted is a normal experience for women, and two, the recognition that women overcome these experiences so are not affected by them. Both of these concepts are chilling to me. Next question. Where would you hope to see the efforts of this movement manifest? Hashtag MeToo moving forward. Overall, our clinicians are also in agreement with Burke, and that is the founder of the MeToo movement. Her hopes for the movement, that it moves the conversation in the direction of healing for victims and for sexual or gender-based violence to be given a voice in terms of social justice. She stated she feels healthy survivors share responsibility in creating a safe space for healing survivors, for which this movement provides forum. Burke also expressed concern for survivors not having space to process their experiences within the en masse movement and being bombarded by the messages, shared experiences on social media. And I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and especially about the effects of activism on victims, their sense of privacy, the ability to heal, and the prevalence of these kinds of stories.
Yeah, I think for some people it's very empowering, and for other people it's very frightening. every victim has to, I think, come to his or her own conclusion whether they're going to out themselves, so to speak, and how they're going to deal with this thing, because people are very different. And I've seen people who've experienced a boatload of trauma who have healed really, really well, and they struggle and they do what they need to do. And I've seen folks who have much lesser forms of trauma just decompensate. So it really depends on the person and how resilient they are to some degree, how many coping strategies they have, how much social support they have, how comfortable they feel coming out about this kind of thing. And what I think folks who come out and have the courage to do that is really cool. I think sometimes people have a hard time hearing it, but I think that needs to be heard. But I think if you're a person who is particularly sensitive, particularly if you're a victim of one of these things, you need to be smart and protect yourself. And, you know, if and when you're ready to do that kind of thing, you can always come out with your story. But certainly once the cat's out of the bag, you're not putting it back in. That's for damn sure.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Okay, so the next part that I want to go over is I'm going to go over a few names that are associated with this for the purposes of establishing levels of wrongdoing within this topic. So there are kind of three basic levels with which we deal here, and I'll list them from most severe to least, to go from what is basic and clear to more and more vague in levels of wrongdoing. The point is to understand how going into witch hunt mode socially forces us to make decisions on gray areas or events with lack of proof. So these are a few names of people that they're very most likely guilty. There's been no denials. There's been clear evidence that's been shared publicly, and they haven't had consequences. There was an article that just came out in People.com a couple days ago that has stated that Kevin Spacey, Steven Seagal, and Anthony Anderson will not even face charges for alleged sexual assault. And we are pretty clear that all three of them have done something that is tortable in some way or criminally chargeable. Other names that have come up in social media quite a bit on this, a couple of these are domestic violence abuse cases, but nevertheless, I'm including them just to make a bigger point. Judge Roy Moore, the actor Johnny Depp, that was for DV, are illustrious commander-in-chief, who I will not name. Actor Sean Connery has actually been a habitual wife abuser for decades. None of these, and there are dozens more like them if I wanted to take the time and comb social media for names. There's a huge chunk of people. We know they did it. Often they've had a consequence, and we just kind of move on. So that's the real basic, obvious black and white ones. The next category is an example list of people that were overly accused. In other words, something was old data, it was a lesser severity, or it was never proven. And I think these are very important because this is part of where the movement starts to hurt itself. Because some of these people might have done something and we're just too dumb to catch them. And we pick on them because we always think it's that. But in reality, sometimes it's really he said, she said. It's not just a defense in court. It really did boil down to that. Or a misunderstanding. Or someone was just an idiot and it's not as big as some of these other cases that are much more clear. So I've got three names for you and a bit of talk about what's going on with them. Al Franken, he had that one picture where he had a hand near somebody's breast. He resigned voluntarily for a crass, consensual photo, which was in bad taste, and the subject still hasn't filed charges. I feel that the tone of this was that she didn't feel it merited them, not that she was afraid to. And he voluntarily censured himself. And what he did is it pales in comparison to what some other people have done who are still in office or working as an actor or whatever else is going on. Second example, a little bit more gray area, Chris Hardwick, who has done a lot of TV work, especially The Talking Dead and that sort of thing. People do dumb shit. The notion that only, quote, bright moral people never have this history, and so anyone who did ever needs to stop existing. Chris's ex-girlfriend posted something that people took to imply meant him. She never even named him. She never pressed charges. There were allegations of emotional abuse, possibly physical abuse or sexual abuse. But, you know, why didn't she press charges now that she went and outed her story? Why didn't she name him? Was it fear of him? Was it lack of proof? Or was this a vengeance thing because she was the ex? We still do not know the answer to that. It has been weeks, and we have no progress on that I'm aware of. And so this is just another example of how a lot of people are really salty and want Chris pretty much to fuck off and stop having a job because they're convinced she's right. And yet, if this was somebody that they're real attached to and they applied those same standards, you know, their best friend could be in jail because his ex-girlfriend wanted to just be a dick and, you know, make up a story. So we're going to also touch on that in a bit about the double standards that people do. And that's why I'm gesturing at these gray area stories. Last one, director James Gunn, who was doing Guardians of the Galaxy. He was fired by Disney because of some tweets from 10 years ago, which, okay, let's be honest, they were crass, frat house, disgusting jokes about rape and pedophilia and possibly Nazis and dead babies and something else. But he never supported these things, hasn't done them, and the tweets were dragged up by a known alt-right activist who specializes in getting people fired just because he can, like he's a professional asshole. And I'm also indicting Disney as a company specifically because, quite frankly, a lot of people do not know this piece of trivia. I was working in a newsroom and I saw the article on it, and that's how I know. Back in 1995, they made this movie called Kids under a subsidiary of Miramax Films. And Miramax was created by Disney so they could have PG films because Disney was always rated G. So they had a different movie house, and the movie house couldn't even do this because it was incapable of having an R rating. So they unrated it because if they rated it, it would have been rated X, honestly. It involved underage kids and sex and drugs and trying to survive in the early days of HIV. This movie pretty much was profiting off everything that James Gunn was joking about in his tweets. So I kind of want to talk about revisionist history. And because people don't know this about Disney, they're all supporting the fact that they fired him for just joking a decade ago about stuff that they're happy to profit from. And I think our society is really crappy about knowing when to hold somebody accountable, how people change, when do you forgive stuff. We have a really hard time with this. And I think that is making this movement harder to navigate and very emotional and awkward. and worse, career-destroying at times. I'm going to back it down one more notch. I don't have many names for this. I only found one quickly, and I didn't. We have a lot of material covered tonight, so I didn't get any more names. But this is a big one, and it's an obvious example of what I'm talking about. List of those flat-out wrongfully accused. George Takei. His accuser turned out to be a lying asshole. George seems to have recovered from his little Me Too moment, but has he really? I don't know. I am somewhat connected to him on social media and a couple of other people that are well connected to him in social media who help him with his and so on. And they stood by him through the whole thing. And I feel badly because I really think very highly of George, but I had to stop for a moment. That's what this movement has done. I've met George personally several times at conventions and stuff, and even in, you know, one-on-one fan things, you know, behind the scenes, not just in the hall in front of everybody. And he has always been consummately gracious and full of manners and polite and all of this. And I had to stop for a moment and just wonder, was I, you know, being unfair by just saying, oh, but he could never because of his reputation. I had to stop for a moment and think about whether I shouldn't do that. And it didn't take me very long to go back and say, you know what, I'm pretty sure George didn't do it. People go through dealing with this topic, and that's why it's so incredibly volatile. And the last one I have is another example of volatility. I said there was three categories. This one's kind of a subcategory. It's a list of supporters of the movement who turned out to be hypocrites. Again, I don't have multiple names. I know they exist, but this is a consummate example. Asia Argento, Dario Argento's daughter. Argento is a key player in Me Too. She was the first woman publicly to accuse Harvey Weinstein of rape. The New York Times revealed that she had paid an out-of-court settlement of $380,000 to child star Jimmy Bennett. Why? According to Bennett, she sexually assaulted him in California in 2013 when he was 17, under the age of consent in that state. It's not under the age of consent in several states, just so you guys know. Argento said the settlement had nothing to do with sex, but rather that she and her late boyfriend, Anthony Bourdain, decided to make the payment to help Bennett out. Ultimately, her guilt has still not yet been proven with certainty, and the case has faded from news, leaving us awkward and uncertain. So these kinds of things happen. You know, the movement gains all of its power, and it ramps up, and then you're going to find some kind of Achilles heel in there. And that was, you know, one of the biggest and first proponents may have been a pedophile, but we don't know. And so now that's just hovering out there, and she's under that umbrella, and she's pretty much going to stay there until we're sure. There supposedly have been tweets that prove Bennett's point. It hasn't been to court yet that I know of. There's some court documents, but I don't know if she's been formally charged. We're not talking about it anymore. So Asia's off in the ether, and we don't know if the person who started it is even on the level now, and that's where we're stuck. So I've got some further somewhat rhetorical comments and questions along those lines. So why do we put up with this in the entertainment industry and in corporate America, but you don't really see a lot of this in blue-collar jobs? Or do you? I don't remember news about it. That could be unfair. Maybe we are, or maybe we see it, but people don't talk about it to the media. I don't know. What is our psychological need to police this? In the end, it's about perceived safety or power, or is it something else? And Dr. Mathis alluded earlier that we have a twisted relationship with sexuality, and I think that may be powering some of this. Next comment. We want to support victims, but sometimes we swing way too far the other way and end up with careers and entire lives destroyed, whether or not the allegations are true, and the damage is never healed. Also, we have false reports. And even if they are later disproven and the person exonerated, their lives are often destroyed anyway. What is it in us that we do this? Jump to defend, pile on the torches and pitchforks before really hearing all sides. What is it in us that we need to do this? And how do we balance making sure victims are taken seriously and not pilloried, as often happens in court? but at the same time, not jumping to life-destroying conclusions. And I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis. I've raised a lot of questions, so feel free to speak to whichever ones that you want to expound on.
Well, I think that part of the reason I'll kind of take these in reverse. How do you balance it? It's really difficult. I think if you take things seriously as they come in and look at the data and see does the facts support the accusations? If they do, then that's one thing. If they don't, then I think you need to drop it. And I think the reason I do think you need to take victims seriously, but you also may need to make sure they're victims before you take them seriously and not victimize them by saying somehow it's their fault. And, you know, I think this thing we have about sexuality, particularly sexuality, let's be honest, with women, right, because I think we're still a little bit in a holdover of, you know, if a guy goes out and has sex with a bunch of different people, you know, that guy's a stud. If a woman does it, she's a slut. You know, and I think it's the same kind of mentality that you see with women in the workplace. And, you know, we give a lot of lip service to gender equality, but I personally think it's horse manure. There are still jobs that women are working at that are getting paid far less than their male counterparts, which I think is ridiculous. I mean, if you're doing the damn job, who cares what you are if you're doing the job correctly? I mean, come on. But, you know, this country was established. I mean, let's go back to religiosity. God is not portrayed as a woman. You know, we have a very male-dominated society here, folks, and we need to just acknowledge that. And I'm not saying it's good, bad, right, wrong, but I am saying it is reality. All right? And yeah, it's kind of like the James Brown song, it's a man's world. That's true, even today. Now, women can do a lot of things behind the scenes, but it's still, and I'm not suggesting there's not competent women and all this kind of good stuff, but I think that we have a tendency to be, males have a tendency to be intimidated by that. And I can say that as a male. I'm not intimidated because I don't give a shit. Excuse my French. But that's because I'm pretty secure in my own abilities. And, I think people who are threatened by other folks aren't secure in their own abilities. So I like smart people. I don't care what color you are. I don't care what gender you are. I don't care what gender persuasion you like to have sex with. Or, you know, I don't care. If you're a smart, competent person, I love you. I don't care. Now, if you're a smart, competent rapist, not so much. But, you know, if you're not hurting anybody else, I'm on board, right? I think we have false reports because people jump on bandwagons and like, you know, their 15 minutes of Andy Warhol fame. I think that's part of it. And I think that we live in a highly cluster B-sized, if you will, society. And I think I made allusions to this in an earlier podcast where, you know, there's a report that came out about a year or two ago that said something like 68% of the American women had significant traits of borderline personality disorder. So how do you define normal in statistics? What is 68 to 69% of the population doing? So what that says is that our American females have a lot of borderline traits. Well, guess what? They didn't interview guys. And my theory is, had they interviewed males, you'd have seen the same pattern in guys, except that guys don't typically had borderline personality disorder. When they get cluster Bs, they get narcissistic personality disorder or antisocials. So my joke, which is not really a joke, is, so had we, if we extrapolate the data and say that 68 to 69% of all American males have traits that are, I'm not saying they are, but they have traits that are consistent with a lot of those that antisocials and narcissists have, you combine that with the female data, what does that say? That says that 68 to 69% of our population have significant cluster B traits. Gee, I wonder why we have the elected officials in office at all levels that we have. Gee, I wonder why we have people vying for attention and making false stuff. Gee, I wonder why we people are doing all and none thinking. Oh, because we're a society of cluster Bs, and that's what cluster Bs do? That's my personal take on it, frankly.
All right. Fair enough. So the next part that we're going to
get into. That's just me. I'm not. Yeah, that's just me. I'm not saying that. Yeah. Okay. Just saying.
Yeah. We always start every show with a disclaimer that this is, you know, your take and my take, and it's not an official answer. It's just us having a discussion. So the next section that we want to get into is resources and advice for improving both victim support and accuracy of accusations. And this is a little more crunchy. This is not like a bunch of hotlines and websites and things like that. It's more the psychology of kind of helping with a lot of the problems we were just discussing. So as an intro comment, what we most hunger for out of this entire experience is a means by which we can get effective help to those being sexually harassed, abused, and assaulted who need it, while at the same time keeping a level of empirical and evidentiary rigor and emotionally neutral responses that we would want done if someone we valued was wrongfully accused. I'd like to discuss the long-term possibilities for the Me Too movement, coping with societal hypervigilance and shame, activism in women versus men, and related topics. So this first part is, in order for hashtag MeToo to survive as a movement or at least leave a legacy of real change. And there's some articles here about this particular subset. First one is The End of the MeToo Movement, What Makes a Movement a Success or Failure by Ira Israel, psychotherapist, career counselor, and relationship coach, published April 13th, 2018 on thriveglobal.com. And my comment here before we start, truth be told, I felt this article said a lot of incorrect or inaccurate things, but it does gesture at a couple of important points about the life cycle of activism and social or political movements. It is part of the problem by erasing Tarana Burke, who I mentioned earlier. She's the founder of Me Too, and implying she is unworthy because she's not famous. One of the comments the article said is that the movement needs a leader, and what they mean is a celebrity leader like Alyssa Milano. And I didn't really care for that point, but it's going to gesture at some things that we need to talk about. So here's some snips from that article. The Me Too movement should be one of the greatest moments in history of the United States of America, along with the abolition of slavery, female suffrage, and the civil rights movement. Please note carefully that all of the above movements ended in the passing or repealing of laws. Or the Me Too movement could inadvertently delegitimize itself by becoming a witch hunt, dissipate, and dissolve into the dustbin of history, along with the Occupy movement and many others. The Me Too movement needs, one, effective leadership, two, a proposed solution and a well-defined goal, and three, a step-by-step path to attaining that goal. I commented earlier on number one. I left it out for those reasons. Number two, the stated goal of the Me Too movement should be something attainable, such as make the workplace as safe as possible from sexual tyranny, oppression, coercion, manipulation, harassment, exploitation, and rape. And this is my comments here. I agree that the movement lacks concrete long-term goals, and it needs to rectify that in order to avoid fading before it helps, and to curb misinformation, propaganda, and misuse of its banner, as happened with Occupy X, Anonymous, Martin Luther King in the COINTELPRO era, and other movements. The article suggests a state law model like the healthcare industry, but they whitewash that the movement heavily targeted politics and entertainment, both of which are not normal corporate business models, and both of which enjoy extreme amounts of unaccountability when it comes to rules and laws that already exist. So the fear of being called out is not taken seriously, not to mention it has been bolstered by recent societal and political climates of getting away with clearly illegal actions. There is no consistent and immediate consequence in these arenas, such as would be in many corporations, and yes, even some of those have C-level execs who are similarly operating above the law. Next article, commentary. After Me Too and Time's Up, what's next? Will action be follow-up to Hollywood symbolism? This is by Anne Hornaday from the Washington Post, and this was posted January 9th, 2018. It was actually online at the Chicago Tribune, to give credit. And this is my comment. Incidentally, this article clears up the difference, albeit subtle and related, between Me Too and Time's Up. Time's Up focuses more on work inequity and sexism, which does play a crucial part in how the sex abuses of Me Too have been tolerated in the entertainment workplace for so long. Quote, in support of the recent initiatives Time Up, Time's Up, pardon me, which seeks gender parity at movie studios and has started a legal defense fund for women in other industries who are sexually harassed and assaulted in the workplace. Many female stars brought along leaders in the areas of labor and community organizing, gay rights, and the anti-sexual violence movement. Curiously, though, no men brought along a real-world activist, leading to the wider question, after Me Too and Time's Up, what's next? When Oprah Winfrey spoke at the 75th Golden Globes in January, the room exploded in cheers, with the women leaping to their feet in support. It was possible to discern some hesitation on the part of their male counterparts, uncertain whether to join in the movement, lest they be seen as interlopers instead of good faith allies. This is the uncertainty, often expressed sotto voce, that now animates many conversations, literal and internal, as men confront the reality that real change will entail the difficult, if not impossible, task of ceding their own creative, gatekeeping, and economic power. As often as not, the movies and television shows themselves that won reflected those same sentiments. Winners included Big Little Lies, The Handmaid's Tale, Lady Bird, I, Tonya, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, all centered on women managing male condescension, manipulation, violence, and narcissism. The still open question is just how far men in Hollywood are willing to go in addressing those issues off-screen in their personal and professional lives. And at this point, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, especially about the life cycle of protest issues and social change, and anything else you want to add.
Well, I think this goes back to my earlier comment about men and males. So, you know, and I would say it to be funny and to be, you know, because, I mean, obviously I'm a guy, so, you know. But, you know, the truth is the truth, and I think that people aren't going to get behind this, male, female, or otherwise, unless, you know, there's enough reason for them to do it, unless they think, you know, because if it's going to cut them money, there's people who will, you know, worship the money versus the correct principle and or, you know, doing the quote unquote doing the right thing. And that's a sad commentary, but it's true, you know. So.
Yep. Fair enough. Okay. So the next point is hypervigilance of most, if not all, unknown males and internalizing generic blanket shame. Because we have been fooled so often and so insidiously by perpetrators, men in our society now are being hyper-scrutinized. This is not to say that this behavior is wrong or not understandable. The article I'm about to read says the opposite, in fact. It's just to highlight a current cultural shift caused by this movement, where many more women than usual seem newly and additionally guarded around strangers who are male. We do acknowledge that not only women are abused and not only men are abusers, but the studies and papers we're about to share may focus on specific gender assumptions. First one, Me Too and the Psychology of Shame, Why Feeling Ashamed for Being a Man is Not an Overreaction, by Bence Nane, PhD, and from Psychology Tomorrow. He is currently BOF Research Professor of Philosophy at the Center for Philosophical Psychology at the University of Antwerp, as well as Senior Research Associate at Peterhouse University of Cambridge. He's a director of the European Network for Sensory Research, which brings together Europe's top psychologists, neuroscientists, and philosophers working on perception and the senses. This was posted on March 21st in Psychology Today. And he says, my dominant emotion in response to the recent deluge of the revelations of sexual misconduct is shame. Not shame for something I did in the past. I believe that I've been better than average in this respect, although probably 80% of men think the same. No, I feel ashamed for being a man. You may think this is an overreaction. Here is an example of why it's not. Yesterday, I was sitting on the subway. A woman got on and there were two empty seats, a fairly spacious one next to me and a really tight one between two women. She chose the tight one. Was she explicitly thinking that I'm a man and therefore suspicious and to be avoided? Probably not. Was her choice influenced by the fact that I'm a man? Probably yes. And I can't blame her for choosing this way. Her choice was perfectly understandable. She was acting on what she saw, and she saw that I'm a man. We are, at least to some extent, who society thinks we are. So by virtue of being a man in 2018, I am seen as a potential sexual predator. This is something to feel ashamed of, like it or not. It's no good arguing that I am different. I'm a different kind of man. I'm a nice guy. It's only the other men who are dangerous. That is completely irrelevant. What matters is that I'm seen as a man with all that that entails. Emotion scientists have a lot to say about shame. The consensus is that shame is not all bad. It can be a positive emotion. For example, it can remind you of your values. Shame can also help you become a better person. But can we feel shame for something we have no way of changing? I can't change the fact that I'm a man, not easily anyway. How does it make any sense then to feel ashamed about being a man? It's true that I can't change being a man, but I can change in some small ways what society thinks of men. And this is a way in which the Me Too movement could turn out to be transformative, not only for women, but also for men. The reaction from men in response to Me Too has not been great, alas. Those who don't ignore or dismiss it are quick to point out how they've never done anything wrong. And I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, especially about societal hypervigilance, shame, improvement, and accountability and that sort of thing.
Well, I think we all need to be accountable for everything that we do, period. Male, female, or otherwise. I feel, and I think we need to be aware of things that are going on and not put our head in the sands, but we also don't need to be, you know, traumatized, paranoid, and looking behind a communist behind every bush. We already had a period where we did that called McCarthyism that really screwed a lot of people up. At the same time, we don't need to put our, you know, head in the sand and click our heels together and go, there's no place like home, there's no place like home, like this shit isn't happening, right? So it's a balance. You know, you have to balance the dangers of putting our head in the sand with being hypersensitive to this kind of stuff, and we just have to keep asking ourselves, where's the data, and is the data supporting it? If it is, let's take action. And it doesn't matter whether it's a man or a woman or whatever. Boundary transgressions are incorrect regardless of who does them, period. Right? Mm-hmm. And as a side note, I don't feel a bit ashamed of being a guy in any way, shape, or form, and I think that this guy's nuts in that regard. I do agree with his he's crazy in a common sense way, not in a clinical way, and in my personal opinion. I do think, however, that he makes a good point that if you feel a little shame or guilt and embarrassment over what some other men do if you're a guy, then be different, be a role model for being different, and let people see that you're different, and speak out about it. You know, there's no need to be ashamed about it. Just, you know, be a role model and speak out about bad things when you see them, regardless of who's doing them. It doesn't matter who's doing them. So, there you go.
That's fair. And this is one of those times when I said I would be bringing up some articles that I think are a little off, but they raise some really good questions that I wanted to point out. This was one of them.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and somewhat related to that, my next point, who among us has not sinned? Now what? Where are the voices of the men? Yeah. So this article, Me Too Meet hashtag Imperfect Men. Why Aren't Imperfect Men Speaking Out? By Robert Weiss, LCSW, CSAT S. He is a digital age intimacy and relationships expert specializing in infidelity and addictions, most notably sex, porn, and love addiction. An internationally acknowledged clinician, he frequently serves as a subject expert on human sexuality for multiple media outlets, including CNN, HLN, MSNBC, Oprah Winfrey Network, New York Times, LA Times, and NPR, among others. This was posted October 18th of last year in Psychology Today. And he says, the Me Too movement has gone viral, with countless thousands of women flooding social media with stories of sexual assault, harassment, and abuse. And that's awesome. It's a gift to our culture to hear, consider, and value these painful stories. But I can't help but think, where are the voices of the men who've perpetrated these abuses? Without the stories of these imperfect men, there is an incomplete discourse. It's the sound of one hand clapping. And I'm going to pause here real quick just to let you know we may have just a few minutes left of our slot. So if I sense that's coming up, I may just jump to the end and I may skip a little bit ahead. When only the victims are speaking out, with men mostly skulking in the shadows and wagging their fingers at infamous abusers, Weinstein, O'Reilly, Isles, Cosby, and the like, pretending those abusers are the sole cause of the problem, we can easily forget or ignore the fact that famous and powerful men like Weinstein are a drop in the bucket. In reality, almost every man on the planet is guilty at some point in his life of inappropriate flirting, catcalling, verbal objectification, pushing for sex despite resistance, or some other similarly misogynistic behavior. No, I'm not saying that every man is a predatory rapist. Thankfully, that's not even remotely the case. I'm simply stating that at this moment in time, we seem to be having an important but incomplete conversation about sexual abuse, harassment, and offending. Please forgive me if you are a fully actualized man who would never, ever push a woman for sex. If so, you're incredible, and I can congratulate you. However, in my 5-plus decades on this planet, I've yet to meet a man who wasn't, at least once in his life, sexist, misogynistic, or overly aggressive with a woman. Every guy I know has at least one story about behavior he now regrets. Maybe he was 19 and pushed his girlfriend too hard for sex. Or he was 38 and drunk at a party and hit on a coworker who wasn't interested. Or whatever. Heck, I'm gay and married to a man for 16 years now, and even I can look back to when I was dating women and see times when I behaved badly, and not just once either. All right, I've got the 90-second call. I'm going to actually check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything else that you would like to make sure to add before we close up.
Nope, I just want to say I like this guy.
Yeah. What I may do is I may keep these notes, and we'll go over this at the beginning of next show so that we don't lose that material. On behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, thanks to our listeners this evening. Appreciation to those joining us later via podcast, iTunes, et cetera. We'll see you guys in 2 weeks on Wednesday, September 19th, 11 p.m. EDT, right here on blogtalkradio.com. Please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody, and rock on. ¶¶